This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 16th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, after two explosions at the Boston Marathon, area hospitals continue to treat the wounded, residents plan vigils, and authorities expand an investigation into the attack. In New York, parents and students boycott high-stakes testing across public schools, and a report finds the U.S. government authorized and used torture following the September 11th terrorist attack in violation of the Constitution. It calls for transparency and accountability. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Boston authorities confirmed today that three people are dead, including a child, and more than 170 people are injured after two explosions yesterday in Boston. Chuck Rosina reports.
Monday's tragic attack on the Boston Marathon turned a glorious celebration into instant shock and horror. The city is still reeling in the aftermath, with 12 square blocks closed to traffic and a heavy police presence. President Obama addressed the nation again this morning.
The American people refuse to be terrorized, because what the world saw yesterday in the aftermath of the explosions were stories of heroism and kindness and generosity and love. Exhausted runners who kept running to the nearest hospital to give blood, and those who stayed to tend to the wounded, some tearing off their own clothes to make tourniquets. The first responders who ran into the chaos to save lives. The men and women who are still treating the wounded at some of the best hospitals in the world. And the good people of Boston who opened their homes to the victims of this attack and those shaken by it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina, Boston.
We'll have more on the Boston blasts later in the newscast. A group of U.S. senators introduced a long-awaited proposal on immigration reform today. While the plan does map a path to citizenship for U.S. residents without legal status, the route is long and costly. And Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions said he's against it.
Really? I mean, I'm opposed to I don't think that's necessary. And actually, I don't even think they would have been asking for it. I think that's the Democratic Party.
The proposed measure includes $4.5 billion for border security to cover personnel and equipment, including drones and fencing. People living in the country without legal status could apply for Registered Provisional Immigrant, or RPI, status, but not until the entire southern border is 90% secure, as defined by the number of apprehensions. Those with RPI status would be able to legally work and travel outside the U.S., but would not qualify for social services. After 10 years, they could apply for a green card, and 3 years later, citizenship. The House is expected to release its immigration plan soon. The son of Senegal's former president is in jail today. Karim Wade is accused of corruption while he held multiple cabinet posts during his father's 12-year rule. Alpha Jallo reports from Dakar.
Karim Wade simultaneously held a number of cabinet posts under his father's presidency from 2000 to 2012. Wade was in charge of huge energy and infrastructure projects under budget. Wade's assets are valued at almost $1.5 billion and include a number of foreign companies, including Dubai Port World, a Moroccan bank, and an airport ground support company. He is accused of amassing his formidable wealth through illicit gains during his time in office. His lawyers submitted thousands of documents to the court yesterday just before his arrest. Wade is also under investigation in France following a complaint from Senegal regarding financial transfers. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
Dozens are dead in Pakistan today after a powerful earthquake in neighboring Iran, the strongest in the region in nearly 50 years. Iranian officials declared a state of emergency following the 7.8 quake centered in the country's southeast. State media report the epicenter was very deep and was located in a sparsely populated region of Iran, but rescuers are still trying to reach remote areas. The tremor was felt in cities around the Persian Gulf coast and as far away as India. It's the second earthquake in southern Iran in a week. Last Tuesday, a 6.1 earthquake struck near the country's only nuclear power plant. No damages to the facility were reported. In Japan, a court refused to shut down the country's only two operating nuclear reactors. Anti-nuclear activists had requested an injunction because the Oe power plant is located on a fault line It's not clear if the fault is currently active. And the Venezuelan government claims they foiled a coup attempt organized by opposition candidate Enrique Capriles and blamed him for Monday night's violence, during which 7 people died. Irina Caselli reports from Caracas.
Few details are known about the 7 people who the government said died on Monday night. 2 were a couple who lived near Caracas. The rest reportedly died when protests across the country turned violent. In a national TV broadcast, Nicolas Maduro spoke of a chronicle of a coup foretold, comparing the unrest to a 2002 coup that deposed Hugo Chavez for 2 days. Maduro blamed the violence on Capriles, who he accused of acting on the whim of the bourgeoisie. Maduro, who was handpicked by Hugo Chavez as his successor, won a narrow victory in Sunday's election. The National Electoral Council proclaimed him president on Monday, but opposition leader Capriles has not accepted the results and has asked for a full recount. Capriles also asked supporters to carry out peaceful protests across the country by banging pots and pans. He also called for a march on Wednesday to the seat of the National Electoral Council to demand a recount. Maduro said he won't allow the march to take place. Irene Caselli, FSRN, Caracas.
From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Federal, state, and local investigators continue to seek evidence in response to yesterday's explosions at the Boston Marathon. 3 people were killed, including an 8-year-old boy, and more than 170 injured after 2 bombs went off near the finish line of the race. At a press conference this morning, Boston Mayor Thomas Menino said the city will overcome.
Yesterday, the terror was brought to the city of Boston. Tragedy was brought to one of our neighborhoods also. This is a close-knit place, the city of Boston. Here we know our neighbors, we grieve for them. We grieve for the little boy who we knew from Dorchester. But also today I want to say we know our heroes also. They are the men and women who wear helmets, who wear the badges, the runners who helped us yesterday during this time of need.
Many of those injured lost limbs. Some remain in critical condition. Dr. Ron Walls, head of emergency medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, said many people were hurt by shrapnel from the blast.
For a lot of these patients, their life will now be divided into 2 parts, the part before that blast and the part after it. And the patients were remarkably stoic to the point of almost being heroic, I would say, able to articulate their pain or their distress or their shortness of breath or whatever they were feeling, really cooperative with the provider teams to really help us to take care of them. Amazing in how they handled the initial pain and the few minutes it took us to get that pain treated properly so they were comfortable. And I would say in terms of recollection, their recollection starts at the moment of the blast. They could tell you where they were, but then there's this event and everything after that.
In addition to emergency responders, runners and spectators rushed to help the wounded. One of those was peace activist and Red Cross volunteer Carlos Arredondo, who was at the race to support athletes running to honor troops who have died. Arredondo's son died in Iraq in 2004. A second son committed suicide in 2011. Moments after the explosions, Arredondo rushed to save the wounded. In one moment captured by a photographer, Arredondo runs down the street with 2 medics helping to keep the wounds closed on a severely injured man being transported in a wheelchair. Later, shaking and holding a blood-stained flag, Arredondo and his wife Melida spoke to Occupy activist Joan Livingston.
And when this bomb blew up, pretty much took off, and these 30 people right there,
right,
and limbs and arms and everything was off. And then a second bomb, just a few seconds later, blew up.
50 yards to the west.
Yeah, very close. And it's 12, 15 yards away from the first bomb explosion, and really took a lot of people down. And thank God, you know, I have the heart to go across and help some people out by putting, como se dice?
Tourniquets on their
I was putting tourniquets with their own clothes.
The FBI is leading the investigation into the bombing, working with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, ATF, Boston Police, and Massachusetts State Police. Special Agent in Charge Richard Deloria said they will continue talking to residents and witnesses in the coming days.
The citizens of Massachusetts and the city of Boston should expect to see the FBI and its JTTF partners conducting investigative activity in the greater eastern Massachusetts and Boston area. Assistance from the public remains critical in establishing a timeline of events which leads to swift conclusion through due diligence and strong investigative activity. We commend the public, we commend the citizens of Boston and the citizens of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for the information that has been provided to law enforcement so far, and we strongly encourage that assistance to continue.
After the explosions, officials halted the Boston Marathon and thousands of runners were stopped short of crossing the finish line. One of those who was running is John Gallina. He is a resident of South Boston and he was running in the marathon to represent the Massachusetts National Guard. He joins us now on the line from Boston. John Gallina, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Describe your experience yesterday at the marathon.
Well, yesterday started off as a great day. I was selected to represent the Massachusetts National Guard, as you said. It was a great honor for me. I was selected out of a pool of candidates to run the 117th Boston Marathon. And, it was just a great day up until about a quarter mile to go to the finish line.
Mm-hmm. So where were you exactly when you started hearing what was happening?
So I was just after the Mass Ave Bridge, about a quarter mile from the finish line, when the race officials and Boston law enforcement jumped in front of the road to stop the runners from proceeding, which I have to commend them. They did a fantastic job and reacted extremely quickly to stop the race.
So what did you first think when you saw them coming in to halt the race?
Well, communication was, there was virtually no communication. So there was essentially, 2,000 runners penned in a corral with no ability to communicate to the outside world.
And at that point, what were you hearing about what was going on?
Well, residents from that lived along Comm Ave were coming out and informing the runners, letting them know that there were a couple of explosions at the finish line and that the race had been ended. But we were kind of stuck in no man's land in that we couldn't get to where, all of our equipment and all of our bags and such were at the finish line, and we just couldn't get there. So folks were kind of stuck and didn't know what to do.
And were you able to get transportation, or did you have to walk to transportation or to get back to your home?
Well, first, before I did that, I had my girlfriend who was also running the race. She was a few miles behind me. Couldn't make contact with her. There was obviously some agonizing. It seemed like forever, probably 15, 20 minutes or so before I could make contact with her. Once I did that, we were able to kind of set up arrange a meeting point where we could meet up. And then we ultimately ended up walking about 2 miles in the direction of South Boston where we live. We were able to get out and contact a friend of ours who actually drove into the city to pick us up and run us back home. Because, of course, we're still in our running gear, cold, damp from the sweat, and it was just, it was an uncomfortable 2 mile walk.
In the course of that walk, John Gallina, what did you see? What was the city like?
I think a state of shock. I saw folks that like myself. Unfortunately, I live in a city. I can't imagine folks that had traveled in from around the world to run this race. They couldn't get back to their hotels. I couldn't imagine being somebody like that. I wouldn't know where they would go.
John Gallina was a runner yesterday in the Boston Marathon. He's also a member of the Air National Guard. He's a resident of South Boston. John Gallina, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
John Gallinat told us he plans to take part in an event this Friday called The Last Five, a memorial walk of the final 5 miles of the marathon. Another event is taking place this evening. It's an interfaith vigil at the Arlington Street Church in Boston. And Katie Scudera, intern minister at the Arlington Street Church, joins us now. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me today.
You are located right near the corner of the Boston Commons along Boylston Street. How far are you from the finish line of the marathon?
I would say that we're about 3 or 4 blocks from the places where the explosions took place. We're very close. We're just the next T-stop up from Copley Square.
So what is the neighborhood like today?
Right now, the streets are closed right up to the front of our church. Our front doors are open, but actually our side doors open out onto Boylston, which is still closed. There's a military and police presence here and a lot of news crews, actually just across the street from our church.
And tell us about the event tonight, the vigil, and who is scheduled to attend.
So tonight we've invited a number of the faith communities in the area to join us for a interfaith vigil. It'll be a candlelight vigil ending with all of us lighting candles of hope and remembrance after these tragic events. So we'll have our church as a Unitarian Universalist congregation. We have other UU churches coming from the surrounding area. We also have a Catholic priest who's going to be speaking. We have Protestant ministers coming. Jewish communities, so a very large interfaith event for the whole Boston community to gather in faith.
And as this gathering is being planned, what are you hearing from your community? What's the response been from your congregation?
The folks who have checked in with us, they're all frightened. This is a very frightening event, and they look forward to coming to our vigil, those who can make it, to kind of regain that sense of community and that sense of hope that comes from being in a sacred space.
Katie Scudera is intern minister at the Arlington Street Church in Boston. Doors open this evening at 8 p.m. for an interfaith vigil. Katie Scudera, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for giving us a call and for getting the word out about our vigil.
You're listening to FSRN. Stay with us. In the decade following the September 11th terrorist attack, U.S. officials authorized and widely used torture techniques that violated the Constitution and many international laws. That's according to a new report from the Constitution Project, an independent think tank that conducted a multi-year on-the-ground investigation in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and at CIA black sites overseas. The investigation found wrongdoing by the Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama administrations and urges greater transparency and accountability going forward. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The Constitution Project's more than 500-page report found that the use of torture by the military and CIA in the years following September 11, 2001, damaged the international reputation of the United States and increase the danger to U.S. military personnel. Brigadier General David Irvine, a former Army interrogator and co-author of the report, told reporters Tuesday that torture also didn't work.
The public record strongly suggests that there was no useful information gained from going to the dark side. Unfortunately, it is a fact that people will just say whatever they think needs to be said if the pain becomes more than they can bear. Other people are so immune to pain that they will die before they will reveal what an interrogator may wish to know.
Most of the report concerns the Bush administration's illegal actions following the 9/11 terrorist attacks. including authorizing acts of torture and facilitating rendition of prisoners to CIA black sites overseas, a program that began under President Clinton. At those sites, the report found, the CIA not only waterboarded prisoners, but slammed them into walls, chained them in stress positions, stripped them naked, and deprived them of sleep for days on end. The Bush Justice Department also went to great lengths to justify these actions, writing memos that defined torture as only acts that led to organ failure. But report co-author James Jones also criticized the Obama administration for maintaining secrecy around these acts, which impeded their research and the work of other groups around the world.
In Poland, an official investigation has been hampered by the U.S. government's refusal to provide any and share any information, even as the Polish prosecutors have issued indictments against Polish officials for their role in facilitating the black sites.
The report praises President Obama for officially banning torture when he came into office in 2009, but criticizes his failure to close Guantanamo Bay, where conditions remain that violate the Constitution and international law. Task Force member Gerald Thompson with the American College of Physicians told reporters that indefinite detention without trial and the ongoing force feeding of hunger-striking detainees at Guantanamo constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment.
If you can imagine being a detainee and using refusal to eat as a form of protest, and then you are forced physically to eat by being strapped into a specially made chair and restrained, your arms, your legs, your body, your head, so you cannot move, having a tube inserted into your throat that extends into your stomach, and you're trying to resist that with the only muscles that are free in your throat. Pain, discomfort, obviously. You're kept in the chair for at least 2 hours, usually more than 2 hours, to prevent you from vomiting and undermining the force feeding. You can't go to the bathroom during that time. Your dignity is taken away.
The authors of the Constitution Project's report on torture said there's still a great deal the public doesn't know about the government's actions over the past decade. In 2009, some lawmakers called for an official truth commission, like those held in South Africa and Guatemala, to investigate war crimes and bring officials to justice. But the Obama administration did not support the proposal. The Senate Intelligence Committee went ahead and authored its own 6,000-page report on the Bush administration's torture program, but it remains classified. Senator John McCain, himself a survivor of torture, told FSRN that making the report public would help hold people accountable for past crimes and discourage future ones.
We're coming up on the 25th anniversary of Ronald Reagan signing the Convention Against Torture, and these people clearly violated a convention that the United States is party to.
The report recommends many government actions to address what they call the stain on the reputation of the United States. These include broadening the legal definition of torture, declassifying government documents about the torture program, and releasing the dozens of Guantanamo detainees who have been held for years after being cleared by all relevant agencies. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Starting today, students in New York State's public schools will begin a series of reading and math tests based on new federal guidelines designed to determine college aptitude. However, not all students will be participating. A group of parents from across the state are opting their children out of the exams. They are encouraging other parents to join them in a statewide boycott effort. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
About 200 students at more than 30 public schools are not taking part in Tuesday's statewide standardized test, according to Time Out from Testing, a grouping of parents, teachers, and civil rights advocates. The exams are being used to determine how New York's 3rd through 8th graders stack up against new federal benchmarks known as Common Core, which New York and 44 other states have adopted.
Every year, 100,000 students leave high school in New York State unprepared for college or career.
Tom Dunn is communications director for the state's education department. He says the tests, which are designed to measure college aptitude, are a way for parents and educators to gauge children's progress as they move through the public system.
The parent who says, I'm opting my child out of the test, is the parent who's saying, I don't want to know how my child's doing.
The Education Department signed a $32 million contract with the publishing giant Pearson in 2011 to design Common Core materials for the classroom. That same year, New York's Attorney General launched an ongoing investigation of the company, raising concerns that it used its nonprofit wing, the Pearson Foundation, to pay for education officials' trips abroad. At a press conference Monday announcing the boycott, parents with the group Time Out from Testing said their children are getting nothing out of the test, but have a lot to lose. Test performances have been used as a justification by the city's Department of Education to close more than 160 schools in New York City over the past decade. Meanwhile, activists say standardized tests such as Common Core fail to take into account social factors such as poverty and the historical legacy of racism surrounding schools. Cynthia Copeland, whose fourth grader attends an East Village elementary school, sees the boycott as an act of civil disobedience in the tradition of the civil rights movement. She paraphrased the words of Martin Luther King Jr.
He talked about the check and that our check is bankrupt. And so we've been given a check for education that is absolutely indeed, maybe it's not completely bankrupt, but it's on the way. But the check has definitely bounced. And we are not taking it anymore.
Some teachers support the boycott. Exam results account for more than 20% of teacher evaluations, and some say they are tired of top-down control over their classrooms. The Movement of Rank-and-File Educators, or MORE, a social justice caucus within the Teachers' Federation, opposes the increased emphasis on standardized tests. In elections this month, they hope to gain control of the union from old guard leadership, which supports Common Core. Through building alliances with parents and students, the caucus also aims to gain greater community control over public schools. At a recent MORE meeting, teachers invited Owen Hodling of Public School 261 in Brooklyn to read aloud from a letter he and his mother wrote to New York City's Chancellor of Schools, Dennis Wolcott.
These tests are wrong. They do nothing but stress us out and take away precious learning time. They do not make learning fun. They are all consuming. The list goes on and on. One question I would like to put out there, as I have stated before, we do not learn anything from these tests. Do we not go to school to learn them?
Common Core English exams are being administered this week, math tests the following week. Parents promoting the boycott hope that over the course of the testing period, more parents will join them in taking a time out from high-stake tests, and ultimately convince officials to shift the school system's emphasis away from the for-profit testing model and put the learning experience back in the hands of teachers and students. Peter Rue, FSRN, New York, New York.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Neil Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.